Hello, hello. So it's a little strange for me to speak like that in this kind of venue, but I guess I have to get used to do things that I was not really trained to do in the pilot course and in my military training. But I'm really happy to be here. So thank you very much for the organizers, and thank you for all of you that came, and thank you for those who even came closer. Because it's kind of strange sometimes to speak about all these emotional things, about decisions that you make in your life, and what you think about certain things that are hard for you and for other people around you to an audience like that. So I appreciate you coming closer. The way I'm going to try to do this hour that we have together is to present a little bit. Myself and my friends in the Israeli activist movement that are struggling right now together with our Palestinian brothers and internationals, and leave most of the time for you to ask questions. So I want to make it as open and free and comfortable event as possible. And you can ask any kind of questions, especially those hard questions, and especially. Those of you who do not necessarily agree with what I do or what I say, let's make a quick check. How many people here have been to Israel and Palestine before? Whoa. Okay. Who have never been to Israel and Palestine? Okay, so we still have something to work on. The last thing on my notes here is to invite you to come because. The struggle is not just hard things and sad moments and hatred and fighting and blood and confrontation. It's also a lot of joy and a lot of love and a lot of getting to know amazing people. And I used to say to my friends that it's like a swamp, you know, when you have many, many hard things happening around, and it's all muddy and upsetting and full of sorrow and grief. The flowers are floating above, like in a swamp. And you meet many incredible people, many incredible souls from all different backgrounds, all different religions, all different countries. And this is an amazing opportunity for one to contribute to what we believe is solutions in this world. And what I'm going to talk today is about what I perceive as my transfer from being part of the problem to being part of the solution. It reminds me something that my teacher in university said once. He's an activist from Norway, and he said that going to all these conflict zones with a lot of death and suffering is very hard, and sometimes you feel that you cannot do so much, and you just maybe make a little difference to two people, but the world is going on in the wrong direction, and you feel very bad. And the answer he gave me to that is that at least we try to be part of the solution and to stop being part of the problem. I want to maybe start because I know, and it's the first time I'm here in Greenbelt. I just heard about it a few months ago, and I'm still in shock. I just landed a few hours ago in Heathrow, and I'm still shocked looking at all these tents and horse race areas and thousands of people. So, and I know that there are many music performances, and people are singing and reading and poetry. So I will start also with a song. This song is a song that was written originally in Yiddish. Yiddish is the language that Jews used to speak in Eastern Europe, and still here and there people are speaking Yiddish. It's a whole culture that a lot of it was destroyed in the Second World War, in the Holocaust. And my grandfather, grandmother, all my grandparents actually spoke Yiddish, and my grandfather taught me this song. I guess you don't understand Yiddish, but it's very similar to German, so maybe some of you will understand. And it goes like that. Es brennt, Briderlach, es brennt. Oi unser Ormstädtel nebech brennt. Beise Winden mit ihr Gossen, reißen, brechen und zerblasen. Starker noch die wilde Flammen, als herumscheun brennt. Und ihr steht und guckt also sich, mit verlegte Hand. Und ihr steht und guckt also sich, unser Städtel brennt. And the song was written in the late 1930s after one of the pogroms in one of the towns in Poland of Jews. After people were massacred and houses and whole towns were sometime burnt down, like happened later, a few years later in the Holocaust. And in English it's approximately saying, burning. Brothers, it's burning. Our whole town is on fire. Please come help put out the fire. Our whole town is burning. People are screaming. The fire, the flames are going to destroy us all. Please come help. But you stand still, embracing hands. You stand idle and you don't come to help us. Please, brother, our town is burning. And this translation is very, of course, I just improvised it, but it's a very, very emotional and strong song. For me, it's being sang in Israel in all the events and Holocaust Memorial Days. And I grew up learning this song, both in Hebrew and in Yiddish. After what happened in the end of 2008, the beginning of 2009, Operation Cast Lid, when my country was engaged in one of the most horrible war crimes, attacking Gaza and bombing thousands of people, leaving almost 1,500 people dead, thousands of people injured, and basically almost the whole infrastructure of the Gaza Strip was bombed. I felt that I don't know what to do with myself. It was so wrong, it was so bad, it was so against everything I grew up on, every principle, every Jewish principle, every idea that I learned in school, at home. And I decided to translate this song that my grandfather taught me to Arabic, and I'll read you just the beginning. Harik ya ikhwan harik baladuna hurikat kulluha wa dukhanuha al-aswad ya'lu wa yasuduha lahabu al-harab atharuha lam tabka innaha تحترق وأنتو مكتفو الأيدي دون أن تمودوا العون وأن تدفئوا لهب النار النار التي بالبلاد. So I just wanted to bring us down to this emotional situation when you realize that something that you are part of is going in a very, very wrong direction. And you want to do something about that, but you still don't know what to do. And allow me to take you a little bit back to about 8 years ago, when I started to have little doubts about my part in this whole big story. I don't know how many of you as children dreamt to be pilots. Many of us, I guess. Every kid I meet wants to be a pilot when he's older. And that's how I grew up. I dreamt to be a pilot. In my case, it was my father as a model. He was a role model for me. Was a squadron commander in the Israeli Air Force, a fighter pilot, and someone at the admired so much and wanted to be like him. I wanted to also fly like a bird in the sky, and it was a great combination for me to become an Air Force pilot and both achieve this amazing dream of flying and also to protect my country, to defend Israel. Those days I felt that my country and me are just the same. My country can be sad and can be happy and can be weak and can be strong, and this is just like me. The identity was linked like that to the identity of this collective, of the idea of country, of state. And then after high school, I went to pursue my dream and become, after 2 years, a pilot in the Israeli Air Force. I was flying rescue helicopters and was very proud to be a rescue pilot, risking my life and the life of my crew in order to rescue injured people, injured soldiers, injured children. Many times after suicide attacks, many times after fighting in Lebanon, in the West Bank, in Gaza. So I saw a lot of blood of my own people. I brought them to hospital, I brought them to safety, and I felt very proud to be part of it. What happened later is that slowly, slowly, you start to realize that maybe there are some problems here. At the beginning, you don't want to believe in it. You don't want to realize that something here is very wrong. But as you said at the beginning, I think some of those assassinations that were held by the Israeli government, the Israeli army, many of them executed by friends of mine in the Air Force. I did not fly any missions of attack helicopters or fighting planes, but close friends of mine were. And slowly, slowly you start to realize that something here is really wrong. I'm crying and I'm so appalled and against all this killing of my people, but here I see that my people are actually killing so many innocents. And it's almost like you have two parts in your brain. One part is the ideas about democracy and freedom and justice and equality and humanity. And the other part is reserved for those things that you don't want to think about. Those enemies, these people on the other side. And if you want to think about it, you can imagine it as, you know, as we look at animals. You know, some of us eat meat, some of us do not eat meat, but we really have this idea that they are animals and we are humans. So what is good for us and what good for them is different. We have this imaginary line in our mind, and that's the way I think I was brought up, to understand that those people over there, the Arabs, the Palestinians, are our enemy. And it's always we and them. It's not us, it's we trying to defend ourselves from them. But the things that are starting to break these walls in your mind are the suffering of innocence, of children. You see how many children are getting killed. You see families that are being destroyed completely by those missiles of these Apache helicopters. You see these bombs that are being dropped in the middle of the night on houses, and the whole family is just evaporate in a second. And these things start to penetrate those walls in our brain, in our mind. And what happened to me and many of my friends is we realized that we have to do something about that. And we can't just continue with our life. In 2003, after many of us went through this process, we gathered together a few friends and drafted the letter that was later called the pilot's letter. We declared that we are not longer willing to be part of these illegal attacks, whether directly or indirectly, and we are going to refuse to be part of the occupation. And we are doing it out of love and concern about our own country, our own people, not just because of the Palestinians suffer, but because we think that it's really against everything that's supposed to support and help our own people. The result of that was, of course, that we were dismissed, we were fired from the Air Force, and many of us went through different directions to become activists and join the big movement that is actually not so big, but it's much bigger than the group of pilots that exists in Israel in the last decades and intensify in the last years. In this struggle against occupation, it's not just saying no. It's not just saying, I'm not willing to be part of this. I'm going to refuse this order. I'm going to not fly this mission. It's also saying what you are willing to be part of. What is yes, what you're saying yes to. It's always important not to just refuse, but also to offer something. And our offer was to try to now go and fix the wrongdoing, try to correct all the bad things that we were part of before. And then the idea came to bring together Israeli refusers, Israeli ex-fighters, and Palestinian ex-fighters, and put them together in one room and let's see what happened. And that's how Combatants for Peace started in 2005, 2006, it was published. We were meeting for about a year without the public knowing because we didn't want anyone to interfere with that. And later on, we started giving lectures and tours inside Israel and Palestine and the rest of the world, presenting us, Israelis and Palestinians, who support mutual existence, are against violence, and basically are very similar. We are much more similar than different, Israelis and Palestinians. The process continues, and today for me, I realize that it's not just to cooperate with Palestinians and create something that is kind of a normal situation between two rivals, between two enemies. The idea I support today, and many of my friends, is that the struggle is the struggle for liberation of Palestinians. And today, I see myself as an Israeli, as a Jew, as an ex-military captain, as an ex-Air Force and all this, joining the Palestinian nonviolent struggle for liberation. And this is a huge change of mindset. It's not anymore about us. It's not anymore about the Israelis who are suffering, who doesn't have, you know, it's hard for us to be oppressors and we want a better life and we don't want to go to the military and we want to just have a happy life with our family. It's about liberation of millions of people that are being oppressed by my own brothers and sisters. This is the struggle. And in this struggle, we have many many ways to act. One of the things that we will talk about more tomorrow is the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And I believe those of you who are aware of the struggle already are maybe even involved in that. Tomorrow, in the session that will be also here at the same time, we will go in depth about this important struggle. In my opinion, this is the way to go, and this is what is going to bring the solution much more than other things and other initiatives that are good, but if we want to emphasize on one thing that can bring us closer to the solution, is concentrating on basically doing exactly what broke the apartheid in South Africa. It didn't break just because of the struggle inside. The struggle inside is very, very important. It's like the seeds of the future that can create a mutual existence, a state of people equal and all these good things. But if you really want to invest your energy and effort in something that will lead to bringing down this horrible criminal apartheid, it's putting this huge pressure as boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And you do it not against Israelis like me, you do it not against the Jewish people, you do it for the Jewish people. because that's the only way we can exist in this little piece of land in the Middle East, if we live as equal, everyone, Jews, Muslims, Christians, Arabs, Israelis, all of us, as equals. It's very simple, but it's very, very hard to convince my brothers and sisters in Israel. So basically, I said completely different things than what I planned to tell you, but that's what I said. I think we can now go for some questions and answers, and I'll give some more ideas and suggestions at the end of this hour. Yes?
Sorry, can we just ask people to come up to the microphone so that it's all recorded? Thank you.
I can't remember who it was who said that the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, but when we look at the Palestinian cause at the moment, where it is riven and factionalized, how easy do you find it to work with a Palestinian movement which in itself is divided and can't agree on what the way forward is? First question, and I'm sorry, second question, how can we give support to you without the accusation of being critical of Israel is somehow anti-Semitic?
Okay. Thank you for the question. Of course, the propaganda machine in my country is very, very developed. And everyone that says one thing or a little thing against the occupation, or even not against the occupation, anything that has a little sound of criticizing the state of Israel, immediately the propaganda soldiers are showing up and accusing you of being anti-Semitic. So it's not just a lie and silly. It's dangerous because it's suggesting that everything that is being done by Israel is about all the Jewish people. And this is an anti-Semitic way of thinking, that one Jew is like all the other Jews, like one Arab is like all the other Arabs, like one Muslim is all the other Muslims. So those who accuse, those who criticize Israel as being anti-Semitic, those people are spreading anti-Semitism because they suggest that everything that the Israeli military is doing is the blame of the whole Jewish people. So we have to break this paradigm. The other practical suggestion is always use people like me and my friends. Of course, we are a minority of a minority in Israel, but still there are thousands of people that are struggling on the ground, and there are thousands and hundreds of thousands of Jews around the world, in this country as well, that are doing everything they can to support the Palestinian nonviolent struggle. So use these voices in order to defend and create this kind of Jewish human shield in order to combat these accusations. Regarding the fact that the Palestinian struggle is with many factions and many inside struggles, I guess it happened all over the history. I don't think even one struggle was always united, and people were always divided. Some of these divisions are the blame of people inside the system that are doing the wrong thing. Some of them are created by foreign powers and by Israel itself. You know, divide and control, it's not the invention of Israel. It's the British Empire and other empires that did it all over. Just a little note about that. You know, in the Mandate days, when the British Empire was in charge of Palestina, there was a time just shortly after the First World War, at the beginning of the days of the Mandate, that the British government in Palestine raised increased the prices of the public transportation. and communist groups and Jewish and Palestinian groups united together, unions of workers and other groups in Palestine, and made a big protest and strike, and the British Mandate was forced to bring down the prices. Jewish and Arab collaboration in the early days of Palestine. Later, after, of course, what the British did is put the organizers of these things in jail because they were very, very dangerous for the control of Palestine. A few years later, after a lot of struggle between Israelis and Jews and Arab Jews and Palestinians in Palestine happened in the big rebellion of the Arabs in 1938, it was much easier, and the prices of the public transportation was, you know, increased, and this time there was no collaboration, and it was much easier to continue and control the group of people. It's just a little example, and you can read about it more in the history books. Regarding the idea of what to do and how to support, I think, as I said in the end of my presentation, joining one of the groups that are working on BDS issues is the first thing. The second thing is coming to Palestine and Israel. Come and join the struggle. As I said at the beginning, the struggle is not just sad and painful. It's amazing. It's just, it's exciting. You meet amazing people. Come to Bilin, come to El Walaja, come to Nebi Salah. If you can enter Gaza, go to Gaza. Go to all these places that you, as British passport holders, can go to and be there as a British person, as an international supporter of the nonviolent struggle for liberation, and you will increase those forces that you support. So this is my two, you know, basic suggestions.
Again, two questions. When we went to Palestine, Israel, we met students from Bethlehem University, and what struck us was that they never had any chance of meeting with any young Israelis of their own age. Is there any way to overcome that? Secondly, I understand that there is recent legislation in the Knesset against the exercise of BDS. How will that affect you and your work?
Thank you. So I'll start from the second part. The new law against boycott is already passed. So we are already a few weeks after it was approved in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament. And basically what I did now is against the law in Israel. And in a few days when I'm flying back, they can accuse me, and I will have to go to court and pay tens of thousands of shekels. And of course I will not pay, and then, you know, they might put you in jail. It was not applied yet. So we are waiting and wondering how they're going to use it, because in some way it's going to help us. Because, and this is important to understand, the lives of Palestinians in Israel under these laws, these new race laws, are not very different. Israel was practically apartheid practicing state toward the Palestinians for decades. So it doesn't change much for a Palestinian that those Israelis who are saying these things are going to now be taken to court by settlers that want to charge them with paying their loss in whatever. It's just affecting the Israeli side. And it's good, because we want to start to wake up the Israeli sleeping peace camp. And the only way to do that is starting to show them that there is an apartheid, that they live in an apartheid state. Because once Israel is practicing these racist policies just toward the Palestinians and the Arabs, the Palestinians with Israeli citizenship and those in the West Bank and Gaza, most of the Israelis do not suffer that, do not feel that. they can, you know, think that everything is fine. So these laws, in my opinion, are just going to, in a way, help us show to the Israelis that it's an apartheid and we have to struggle against it, and to people around the world that there is an apartheid. Regarding the first part of the question, this is the most important thing, to let people see each other, meet each other, and create a dialogue. Me personally, one of the most significant moments of change when I actually realized that something is very, very, very wrong in me being part of the military, is when I was in a meeting with Palestinians in this village of Jews and Palestinians living together. And in this dialogue, I realized that I have to do something. It was not before. It was the moment when I sat together with Palestinian students, just side by side, realizing that even if I never shot anyone myself, for them, I am the example of the oppressor. And this moment is so, so profound, and we are trying to create it in these meetings, bringing people together. But we have now walls all around Bethlehem, for example. Just a few meters from Bethlehem, there is the village El Walaja, that they are building now a wall that will surround the whole village, 360 degrees, in order to build a settlement right on the village, between two streets that are in the valley. Up in the hill in the middle, there'll be a settlement, and the whole village, just by Bethlehem, will be surrounded 360 degrees with walls. So it's gonna be much, much harder for us to bring people to meet each other. So these things are important, but we are not counting on that today. The dialogue is important, but we are not anymore waiting for all the Israelis to wake up. It's really important to understand, because it's also being used sometimes, this dialogue and this bringing kids together to play soccer together and to go to the sea together. It's nice, but sometimes it also helps to create the illusion that something is normal here, but something is really not normal, and we don't want to give this feeling of normalization. But I will be the first one to support any kind of dialogue, because that's what brought me to be here today.
Thank you. Hello, Jonathan. As a British Jew who has some major issues with Israel, it's fantastic to have you here and to hear what you've got to say to us. I'm interested in hearing what you might say to the British Jewish community here, whose identity as Jews is very much bound up with support for Israel. And I wonder, you know, what can we say to the Jewish community here, whose identity, their self-understanding, is so tied up with support for a Jewish state? How do we break that paradigm of Jewish understanding?
Thank you. Is Glyn Secker here? Here. So this is my friend Glyn, and he's from a Jewish... what's the name of the organization? Jewish for Justice for Palestinians, and a British organization. And Glyn and me were together on the Jewish boat to Gaza. Glyn was the captain, and I tried to help him as much as I can. We were all arrested at the end, as probably some of you know. And this is one of the solutions. I think also non-Jews can help this organization, and also other groups of Jewish British that are struggling for justice and for supporting the Palestinian and Israelis who are struggling against occupation. So I think that the first thing we have to do is to join forces. When we are one upset Jew in his living room looking at the news and cursing, we don't help so much and we get more frustrated. But if we are two frustrated Jews together, maybe we can make something. And if we join an organization that is already existing and doing incredible things, and we bring our ideas and new initiatives, I think that's the way to go. So we have to join forces. And joining forces sometimes means to also overcome differences. Okay, so one will be for, you know, one state, like I believe that we should all live in one state and be equal. And one should be for two states, but are this and that. I think we should all join forces in these issues in order to create an impact. So it means sometimes that we have to also not be completely strict with our political agenda in order to create a movement that will be stronger. The other practical thing is to bring more Israelis, young Israelis, that will speak to the hearts of the Jewish society here. There are amazing, amazing young boys and girls that are doing amazing work in Israel and Palestine. Some of them are going to, I think, if you invite them here, attract a lot of audience because, for example, we have the daughter of the deputy former commander of the Mossad with us, refusing to go to the military service and sitting in jail for months for her refusal. We have people that are offsprings from very high Zionist right-wing people that are part of the movement of liberation in Palestine. So I think bringing people like that, that in one hand will have the credibility that will open the doors of some Jewish community centers or synagogues, that's a way to go. Me, personally, I will probably now will have a very hard time to get invitation from certain groups of Jewish people in England because I already said everything I think and I consider to be too radical or too dangerous or, you know, not a nice guy. But use those fresh voices of young Israeli activists and bring them here in groups and in tours. And it takes, you know, we have to organize things. We have to organize tours in schools, in high schools, in universities. So it's a lot of work, but I believe that we have the human resource to do that.
Speaking as a Republican, Irish Republican activist for the last 30 years, one thing I immediately recognise is your moral courage in moving from the position you had when you were beginning in the military to seeing how things were and changing, and I salute that. The question I have, looking at the bigger picture, is what do you think the Israeli government's ultimate goal is, particularly in Gaza, I'm thinking of, but in the bigger picture in the Middle East as a whole, you know, as the greater Israel, what do you think their goal is, and how do you think they can be stopped in their objectives, which would appear to be so damaging for the future of peace in the region?
Thank you. And by the way, one of the things that inspired us when we brought Israelis and Palestinians together was groups in Ireland from the south and the north that came together and did a very similar thing. Not always very successful, not always very easy, but it's still inspiring. I think we learned a lot from this. Regarding the goal of the Israeli government, you know, the Israeli government is changing. It's not always the same government. I think the current government, which is clearly a very fascist and upfront, you know, it's not like in the past. In the past, they would speak about peace and do war. They would speak about, Oslo Accord and increase the amount of settlements or the amount of settlers in, 200%. Right now, we have a government that is kind of very clear. You know, all the facade of Israel is trying to make peace with its neighbors is kind of gone. Now we have Avigdor Lieberman. I don't know if you heard about, he's the foreign minister. And it's great. I think if one thing I don't want to change in the next few months, I don't want this guy to leave his office, because this is the first, this is the best tool we have now to convince the world that they have to boycott Israel. When we have such a fascist and racist minister in such a high position, it's just helping us convincing the world that we have to change this paradigm. So if you ask me personally, I think that the current government would prefer to see Palestine, to call them a state, but actually create enclaves of small towns surrounded by walls and fences and all these electronics that will monitor them, and, you know, drones from above and tanks from outside. And these enclaves, these ghettos, will function as the state of Palestine. And Israel will continue to be something like along the lines what you see now, with big big areas of settlements. Maybe few settlements will go, but the idea is to create fractures, you say, of little enclaves that will be called Palestine. And of course, this will not be anything close to justice and to peace, and it will just be continuation of the bloodshed and basically ghettoization of Palestine, which is already quite a lot happening now. The way to battle it is, again, to wake up policymakers around the world by creating huge movement of civil society that will push for cutting military aid from the United States, $3 billion a year. 1.8 of these $3 billion is just military weapons. Changing laws and situation in Europe, the European Union Association Agreement, that suggests that if Israel do not follow the basic humanitarian laws, it will not benefit all the financial benefits that the agreement, the trade agreement with the European Union, and it's already signed like 5 years ago, but never implemented. And basically, the BDS. BDS, BDS, BDS. And we have many creative ways to push forward the BDS, and I'll talk more about it tomorrow. But even things like convincing singers and musicians not to come to perform and entertain the apartheid in Israel is going to contribute to what you and me and all of you believe as the right thing to do. So there are many creative ways to go forward with that, but it takes a mass movement of civil society, because it will not come from the government. The government have other interests, as you see what happened now in Greece a few weeks ago, when the Greek government completely blocked the flotilla, completely against the wish, the will of the Greek, of the people of Greece. I believe that 80, 90% of people in Greece were totally for us. They wanted us to go and try to sail to Gaza with all the boats. But the governments in Europe, and of course in the States, are not necessarily acting in the favor of justice and human rights, and it will come from the civil society.
I've always been very fascinated in what it must do to a country and the psychology of a country where every citizen, man and woman, goes through military training. And I think, am I right, you stay on active, ready for service through your life. I'd be really interested in your perspective of how that can change and perhaps corrupt the psychology of a nation. And I wonder, when the enormous moral authority that you and your colleagues had in speaking out as active combatants, there must be so many people in the military who feel, remember their humanity, but have a job, and whether that how you can encourage Israelis to remember their humanity and perhaps forget their military indoctrination.
Yeah, it's a huge topic, and I can talk about it for hours probably. But how to convince people, it's maybe the $1 million question. I strongly believe that, and we are trying to do that, that conversations like arguing about politics is not leading mostly anywhere. So if I had a friend of mine or a former colleague of mine in the Air Force sitting here now, I don't think I can convince him to refuse just by talking about all these points that I can write here. I think the change comes when you see something on the ground. When you go to a checkpoint and you see people being humiliated, when you go to a nonviolent demonstration and you see how the people that you believe to be moral, the most moral army in the world, are shooting at kids with these tear gas canisters that sometimes kill. You need to see things on the ground, and that would bring the change. So what I'm trying to do with these people, and sometimes I succeed, sometimes I fail, is to try to bring them with me to see something, to meet someone, to challenge these parts in their identity that are there, but are kind of suppressed and sleeping. As I said at the beginning, we have like these imaginary barriers in our mind. We create these compartments, and we need to break these walls so the values will reach the other side. And sometimes it's really frustrating. Sometimes it's really, really sad because you see a person that is so nice and so amazing and so nice to his daughters and to his wife and to his friends. But then when he's being called from his squadron, he will go and drop bombs on civilians in Gaza. And it's the same incredible, horrible situation we remember from, you know, the German guy that teaches his son to play violin and then go to his work in, you know, the concentration camp. And I can give examples from all nations and all parts in history. It's not necessarily just Germany. It's like a British nice guy being very nice to his family and mother and sisters and friends and children, but then going to Iraq and kill civilians and become a brutal, brutal animal. And actually, when I say brutal animal, it's not correct, because the most brutal animal is human, is man. The other part of your question was how does it affect all this military apparatus, all this compulsory service? I think it's deeply affecting everything. And some people in Israel say that Israel is the Israeli military has a state or something like that. You know, all the big leaders, all the ministers, many of them were previously commanders in the Air Force, in the Army, in different commando units. The military is deep rooted inside everything in the Israeli culture. And don't get me wrong, the Israeli culture is still something that I long to and I love, and the Hebrew language and literature and songs and poems and art are amazing. And I'm also trying to be an artist in my other life and a musician in Israel, and they're beautiful things. But the military is like the militarism in Israel is like a disease that is going all over and very, very deep into every part of the society, and we are trying to cure it from. There is an organization called New Profile that you can Google and read a lot about them, and their basic aim is to try to demilitarize the Israeli society by helping young kids and young teenagers realize that they can actually do other things than going to the military, giving lectures about feminism and militarism and all these things that they are all combined. And once we understand that all these struggles are one, it's not just to be against the occupation, but you know, show your ranks and say that you know, as a military person, you have more authority than someone else. It's realizing that it's all one struggle. The struggle for women's rights, the struggle for liberation, the struggle for anti-occupation and demilitarization of the society. It's all many parts of one big struggle. And this is really, really important to make these connections. It's by doing these connections, we can try to lead to somewhere better. But it's a very, very difficult process. I think we might have time for just one question or...
My question relates to demography. I read a frightening book last year by Eric Kaufman, Shall the Righteous Inherit the Earth? Shall the Righteous Inherit the Earth? And he's arguing basically that religious fundamentalists all over the world have learned that what they've got to do is grow their own as a response to the pressures of modernity. And, for example, in Israel, by 2050, the majority of the population will be Haredi Jews if... the present trends continue. And given that many of the secular Jews that I've, or Israelis that I've met have left Israel disillusioned with what's going on at home, or secondly, are the ones who don't have a big, you know, they're not impacting the population, this is a worrying trend for the future. So the question is, are you going to have lots of kids?
I don't think I'll have a lot of kids, but maybe a few. I do agree that, and it's not just me. Many scholars are saying that the future, as we see it now, will be that the more religious, nationalist people will stay, and the other will leave. We not even not have many kids, but they will leave the country, because even those. Israelis who are now supporting the occupation or kind of indifference, they will just don't want to live in this kind of lifestyle where you have all the time blood and fighting and ghettos all around. So this is a great threat that the population will become more and more radical religious and more fascist. And don't forget that, and it's not something that I am telling you, but it was written all over, that they have all different kind of weapons over there, and those who will stay to be in charge of all this weapon are going to be more and more radical, more and more dangerous for the world. That's why we have to act now in order to prevent that, because the Israel and Palestine, or however we are going to call it in the future, could be also an example for beauty and culture and multiculturalism and multi-religious and beautiful ideas and people from all over gathering together, building something beautiful. So we have to keep this hope here and go for it, and not just to think that we are going to lose and it will stay, it will become more and more fascist and more and more radical religious. Okay, and then after him.
You mentioned America and it's in the amount of money that they pour into the state of Israel, and obviously they give a lot of moral support to the Israeli position. What's being done in America to capture the hearts and minds of Americans to change the view of the American government? Because, to my mind, without a change in the American position on the Zionist state, you're never going to win this one.
Yeah, thank you. This is, of course, one of the most important things, because we know that once the United States will stop supporting the occupation, probably will not be able to continue. We get the $3 billion a year. As I said, $1.8 billion is military aid. All the airplanes, Air Force weapons and bombs, almost all of it is from the United States. And basically Israel is sometimes seen as, you know, the 51st star on the U.S. Flag. And without their support of the occupation, without their support of the ongoing colonization and ghettoization of Palestinians, the occupation will not continue. So the struggle in America is one of the most important. And as you know, there is AIPAC, the right-wing Jewish lobby, that is one of the most dangerous, maybe, lobby groups. And there are now more and more Jewish American organizations struggling against AIPAC. And there are many, there are like mushrooms coming up in different towns and cities in the States. There is a Jewish Voice for Peace, an organization that a few years ago had 7 chapters and now have 27 chapters. It's spreading all over the United States, and the Jewish voices are getting louder and louder. And I think from my experience of being in the States, and I'm working there part of the time, more and more young Jews in the United States are breaking out from this very old paradigm of Zionism, and in some way, the way they teach people in the Jewish community in the United States is to worship Israel almost as if it was God. You know, you have many supposedly progressive Jewish groups of even Reform Jews that are so hardline when it comes to Israel, and it sometimes looks as if they change the idea of worshiping God in Judaism in worshiping the state of Israel. So I see more and more young Jewish from young generation breaking out from that and joining the struggle, and I believe this is one of the ways to go. Another thing is the big financial crisis that the United States is going through now. You know, it's not a good thing, but I think it might also wake up more and more Americans to realize, hey, my country is on the verge of financial collapse, and we still give $3 billion to one of the strongest economies in the world. Why do we do that? So even that could somehow indirectly help us convince the American people to stop this military aid and this support of the occupation. We'll have one friend of us make an announcement, and then I'll say just one sentence.
Thank you very much. According to the polls, most people in this country support the idea of Palestine being recognized as an independent country and admitted to the United Nations. But none of the major parties in this country have yet come out in favor of that, even though there's going to be a vote in the United Nations on this very question in a few weeks' time. So I would very much like to know whether most people in Israel, as in this country, would support that. We're running a petition here to get people to write to their MPs to get them to pledge to support the idea of an independent Palestine. You're very welcome to sign the petition and write to your MP. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll just say in one sentence, and we can talk about it in length tomorrow because we have another session here, and we can talk more about BDS, more about the flotilla, and also about the Palestinian statehood. I think the good thing about that is that it put Israel in the corner. It put the right-wing Israeli government in a very particular corner when they just doesn't make sense. They really don't make sense, and more people in the world are waking up because of this tactic of Palestinian statehood. In other point of views, it's a little problematic because it's not including the Palestinian diaspora and refugees, and many people see it as an inside thing in the political Palestinian game that is not necessarily going to lead to any change on the ground. So me personally, I like to see how the Israeli government is crumbling under this impossible situation where they just become more and more ridiculous in their reactions to that. But I would still emphasize more on the civil society and pushing for boycott and divestment and sanctions than on this side. But who knows? We will probably know in a few weeks. Thank you very much, and I invite all of you and your friends to come tomorrow, and we'll talk more in depth about the struggle. Thank you.